I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Kyle Riabko joins me now. The singer, actor, guitarist, and composer has just released a new album, Richard Rodgers Reimagined. It's a great collection of 12 Richard Rodgers songs that highlight the durability and timelessness of his music, as well as the charm and modern sensibilities of Mr. Riabko, who does the vocal and instrumentation himself. Whether it's My Funny Valentine, My Favorite Things, Oh What a Beautiful Morning, or Some Enchanted Evening, Kyle's pop rock sensibilities infuse the songs with a contemporary spin that make the performances something new and enjoyable for the listener. I'll get Mr. Riabko to tell us about this album, the music of Rodgers, and his career thus far. Kyle Riabko has starred in the Broadway productions of Spring Awakening and Hair. He has already released a full-length album of original music. He has appeared as an opening act for such artists as B.B. King, James Brown, John Mayer, Buddy Guy, Maroon 5, and many others. He's appeared on television and in film and created and starred in a show, Close to You, Bacharach Reimagined, which was nominated for many awards off-Broadway, and which Burt Bacharach said that Kyle had, quote, done something truly unique with my music, and that, quote, he's a beautiful singer and one hell of a guitar player. I'll also get Kyle to tell us about how he came to do this album and the connection with Bacharach. The album is out now from Ghostlight Records. KyleRiabko.com is the website for more. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Los Angeles, Kyle Riabko. Mr. Riabko, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man.
You're very welcome. This is a great album, as I was just telling you. These are songs that a lot of us who like popular music will know, and you bring such a freshness to these songs that it just makes it terribly entertaining and just delightful to listen to.
Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate that.
Was it fun to do? I mean, was it fun to take these songs and then put your own take on it, say?
You know, fun is a good word. It's kind of like, It's nothing but fun when you're sort of reinterpreting or arranging a song that is known to be, you know, a piece of perfection. It's an unbreakable masterpiece. Then all you can do is have fun with it, you know. So I really enjoy doing this kind of thing, especially with music that is just as undeniable as this.
Yeah, and you listen to your album, and you realize just how durable and timeless these songs are. That
yeah.
are, some of these songs are 60, 80 years old, some of them. I guess what I want to know is that because people are still performing these songs year after year, and when you perform them in the style that you've arranged them in, what are you thinking about as you're reimagining them, if you will?
Well, I'm thinking about it's on a song by song basis for me, so it kind of depends on where the song takes me, really. And I think about a number of things. I think first of all, durable is also a really good word that you just used that I've been using a lot lately when I'm talking about these songs, because they're so durable that you can take a blowtorch to them and they still work. You know, so I think of myself as the blowtorch. It's kind of like if I stretch and push and pull this thing and set it on fire, you know, what's the most creative way I can do that and still have the melody sing through? So, you know what I do? I look at the song and I listen to it a little bit, and then I just go back to what I did when I was 11 years old in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. I pick up my guitar,
uh-huh.
and I play it with my guitar. And because these songs aren't known as guitar songs, and because I didn't grow up with this music, I grew up with you know, rock and blues, it innately comes out differently. And my fingers fall on the fretboard in a specific way that's unique to me. And so it just kind of sounds different by virtue of that. So, and then every song has a different sort of, I arrange it a certain way for a different reason. It's just sort of how it speaks to me.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you just pick 12? I mean, you easily could have had twice the number, right? Or if not more.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many songs. And we had the same issue with Bacharach. You know, it's just such a huge, in enormous catalog and so many songs that people would expect to hear and love. And I start with, you know, 100 songs, listening to them. And what's great about, one of the things that is great about the streaming age, and there's a lot that, you know, us musicians complain about, but one of the great things about it is that you can just in 30 seconds make a playlist of not only, you know, My Funny Valentine, but 100 different artists playing My Funny Valentine and just sit there and listen to it for inspiration, you know. So I do that for a while, and then really, like, honestly, it's there are some songs that you go, okay, you can't have a Richard Rodgers album without Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. So, okay, that's going on for sure. Mm-hmm. But then beyond that, it's kind of because these songs are so universal, I just start to think from a personal perspective which one just happens to strike me on a personal level, whether that's because of the melody or the chord structure or the lyrics. And then you just start to whittle it down that way. But it's kind of like, you know, I love these old albums that Ella Fitzgerald did, where she would sing an entire songbook. So there actually is an Ella Fitzgerald sings Richard Rodgers, which you probably know. Uh-huh. And then there's one where she sings Gershwin. And they're like two or three, some of them are even, I think, like three LPs long. Uh-huh. And she just sings through the whole songbook, and that is cool. And there's a reason for that, because there's so many great songs.
Yeah. What's marvelous when I listen to your album is this marriage between the music and the lyrics, and whether they're written by Larry Hart or Oscar Hammerstein, the music of Rodgers just comes through, there's a strain through them that you recognize as Rodgers right away. What's he like to perform?
Oh, I love performing. I mean, the thing about performing songs like this. You know, what I love about performing in general is sharing. You know, like, to me, music is all about sharing. It's finding a personal take on a song, but then ultimately the reason you're doing that is to share that with other people. And I just did some concerts of this in Los Angeles and New York, in a couple different venues. And when you start a song up, and sometimes it takes 8 bars, 16 bars for me to get to the melody for people to get which song it is. The way that their faces light up when they hear a melody or a lyric that they grew up with is sort of an unbelievable thing, because it's at once universal but also very personal, because you can see in each person's eyes in the audience, you know, a memory of their mom singing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, you know, when they were growing up, or my favorite things to them might make them think about the movie, or might make them think about Christmas, or whatever. It's just such a cool, you know, when you're playing original music, part of the goal is to just sort of like get people to get you, and you see their eyes sort of like, okay, yeah, I'm hearing this for the first time. But it's an entirely different thing when you play music that they've heard hundreds of times. And it's really joyful. It's really joyful. It becomes a community event.
There's a song on the album, I Have Dreamed, from The King and I. It's not the first song we think about when we think of that show, that film. It's an underrated song, because I've only really I've only really appreciated it, I guess, in the last couple of years when I heard Sinatra do it. And when I hear you sing it, I mean, it takes a lot out of you, it seems.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And by the way, it's the Sinatra version that got me into that, too. I've never seen The King and I. I mean, I really don't, and I'm sort of, like, honest about this. This is not the music that I grew up with.
Right.
And I didn't grow up with musicals or even musical movies or any of that kind of stuff. It's just I fell into it later in life when I joined the cast of Spring Awakening on Broadway. And then but before that I was sort of a guitar playing sort of blues kid. And so, but I quickly learned how amazing the music of especially the classic musicals of Rodgers and Hammerstein and Rodgers and Hart is. And so when I hear I Have Dreamed, you know, I had no connection to the movie or the musical at all. It was just sort of, oh, that's a great song. It's Sinatra's thing.
Yeah.
And it was, that was the case where my manager and the executive producer of this album, he's a little older than I am, and he did grow up with this music, so we're kind of like a bit of a yin and yang in that respect.
Uh-huh.
And he pointed me in the direction of that song and said, you should check it out. There might be something there. And then I listened to it, and we just said to listen to it, and the two words that came to us was Stevie Wonder. You know, like, what if Stevie Wonder performed this song? And that's kind of just, that was the inspiration for the arrangement.
Yeah. The so you mentioned Bacharach, and I know you've gotten to know him quite well. I'll ask you about that show in just a sec. But
sure.
I understand that the genesis of this album was because you'd seen a letter that Rodgers had written Bacharach. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. Yeah. So when I first started, and we'll get to that, the Bacharach show. When I first started working on it, the first step of that process was to arrange Bert's music, and because unlike Richard Rodgers, Bacharach is still around, I had to take the arrangements to his house, bit by bit as I was recording them at home, and to get his approval. And so I would take these trips over to his home, and just sort of like a student of pop history, I'd walk in that front door and pretend not to be, you know, glancing at the walls and reading everything and looking at the, like, engraved Oscars and Grammys on the mantelpiece. It's just, like, it's crazy. And at one point, something popped out at me in a hallway. It was a framed letter on the wall in a very sort of prominent place where Bert, it seemed like Bert sort of wanted you to see this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I looked closely, and it became clear it was a fan letter to Bert from Richard Rodgers. And basically, you know, paraphrasing the letter, he says, you know, Bert, I love what you're doing. I think you're the future of music. Mm. You know, melody is key. Keep it up, basically, type of thing. And he wrote this to Bert in I think it was 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real passing of the torch. And then as I dug a little deeper, I realized that the admiration went both ways. Bert loved the music of Richard Rodgers, and you can find old interviews in, like, Newsweek and Time and stuff where Bert cites Richard Rodgers as one of his greatest influences. So I just kind of lodged that in the back of my head. I just thought, okay, if I have some time at some point, it would be cool to dig into Richard Rodgers in the same way that I am with Bert. So that's basically what happened.
Yeah, and so I'm sure you've talked to Bacharach about Rodgers. I mean, did he tell you about some of the favorite songs that he had of his?
I don't know that he's ever told me favorite songs of his, but there is one story that I think is kind of wild. And and for someone who is into, you know, the history of musical theater and stuff. So, I mean, a lot of people wonder why Bert, Bacharach, and Hal David only wrote one musical, which is Promises, Promises,
right,
in 1965. And there's no real answer for that. It was a hit musical, but they never wrote another one. And Bert tells this story where the musical was up and running, and he was happy with it. It had opened, the reviews were great, and everything was fine. But as you know, a musical isn't just opening night. It then runs for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and it's just this machine that has to keep itself going. And so Bert, you know, moved back to Los Angeles, and he would get the performance sheet every night that's from the production staff saying just, you know, how the show went, you know, if anyone of interest was attending, and blah, blah, blah. You get this every night when you create a show. And one matinee, the performance report said the first trumpet player is out with a cold, the drummer is out with a flu, so we have two subs coming in for them. Oh, and violin player number two is out, viola's out. There were like six or seven key musicians in the pit band that had substitute players that day. And then at the bottom of it, it said, oh, and Mr. Richard Rodgers was in attendance.
Huh.
And Bert flipped out about this, just the fact that Richard Rodgers was going to see an imperfect show.
Yeah.
And if you knew Bert, when you he's a scrupulous, like, perfectionist. And so I always wonder about that moment, and I wonder if, you know, his lack of control, the fact that musical theater is this living, breathing thing where things can go wrong, I just wonder if that is why Bert didn't end up writing another one.
Hmm. Yeah. And now this show that you did, the previous project, the Close to You, the songs of Bacharach that you performed, that was you did that in England, is that right?
Yeah, we did it in New York first, mm-hmm. At a off-Broadway theater called New York Theater Workshop, and did that for several months, and then we moved it to London. We performed it on the West End there.
Yeah, and so what's it like? You know, I mean, you've gotten to know him as you have, but when he hears you perform his music, and he says that you've done something truly unique with it. I mean, that's pretty. I mean, that must be cool, is it?
It's amazing, yeah. And that's like that. That's the best and most important thing to me. And that's been the gift of this. Is just sort of being around him and paying tribute to his music and having him around to see it and hear it. And I mean, that's like pretty special, and I don't take it for granted ever, the fact that, you know, this legend has entrusted me with his catalog. Uh-huh. And that's why I continue to this day to play shows where I play the Bacharach music and sort of tell the story, and because I really feel like it's an amazing catalog of music that my generation of listeners doesn't necessarily know very intimately, you know, or they know it, but they don't know they know it, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I'm a nerd when it comes to music. I love it so much. I love studying the history of it, who made the music and when and why. And so with Bert, you're sort of living in the middle of one of those history books, and that's just, like, for me, the coolest thing.
You've always had that, though, in your career, a great support from musicians, even in your early days as a performer up here in Canada with Randy Bachman and this great list of people that you've opened for on tour, like B.B. King and James Brown and others.
I've been really lucky, yeah. I've been really, really lucky. I think it might be because I started as a kid. Like I was such a kid that the guitar, if you look at pictures, it's like 10 sizes too big for me. It's like there's more guitar than boy. And I think there was sort of like they saw me trying to do something, and it was, you know, they wanted to help guide me along, if that makes sense, because you start to recognize that for the most part, the guys who have succeeded the most, or the guys that are the furthest at the top of the mountain, tend to be the most generous. You know, they tend to send the elevator back down, so to speak.
Yeah.
And those guys really, really did that for me.
The you mentioned Spring Awakening and you also did Hair on Broadway. You mentioned earlier that this was not your background, that you just sort of fell into this. But the discipline that Broadway teaches you, I mean, you replaced, on Broadway you replaced Jonathan Groff. That was the original cast, and then you toured the show, is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, so what's it like to do that and What is doing a show 8 times a week? What does that teach you about performing?
Oh man, that's a great question. That was the learning curve, you know, because I had been on stage thousands of times and I knew what it was like to sort of handle an audience and handle a room and have fun on stage. But performing something 8 times a week, and getting as close to perfection as you can each time, that is a major, major sort of reality check for a young performer. And it really, it does come down to just that discipline. It's like you really grow up fast and you realize, oh, I can't play the Wednesday night show and then go out until 2 a.m. and then be ready for the Thursday matinee or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
I cannot do that. And you try it once, it's like putting your hand on a stove. And then you realize, oh, that's not going to happen. So it really, I ended up loving that. I mean, it's difficult because it starts to become a bit of a sport as well as an art, you know, because you have to keep your body in good shape. And this is all stuff that no one touring in a rock band thinks about. You know, you can do one of those shows with a horrible cold and 100-degree fever, you know, but with this, you have to be in tip-top shape. So yeah, it was a major learning curve, man, and I came to really like that because I'm sort of a little OCD and a little bit of a perfectionist, and so the idea that you're presenting this piece that's finished like a painting to an audience every night, I really like that, and it's a captive audience too. You know, it's not many other places, venues in the world other than a Broadway theater or a Broadway-style theater where you can sort of stand there as a performer and know that the people that are in there paid to sit down and really watch and pay attention. Yeah. You know, that's really nice.
Are there other roles in the theater that you'd like to pursue, say, later on?
Yeah, maybe. I never have, like, an answer, like, specifically which role.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm always always on the lookout for stuff like that. And when something comes up, you know, for the last handful of years, I've been so busy with these projects that I created. But it's funny you say that, because just now we're starting to sort of sift through a few things and go, oh, that might be worth pursuing, you know. But I'm just like everyone else. I have to go through the whole process and audition for stuff and go through a whole thing. It's not like you do a couple of these shows and suddenly you're, you know, getting offered everything. It's a humbling experience, you know, every time.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that you're recently married.
I am. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, I saw the video on YouTube that you and your, I guess, now wife did about a year ago. It was Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, was it?
Oh, you said, oh, God, I guess it's time to repost that.
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, and she's a marvelous performer in her own right.
Thank you. She's amazing.
So you guys live in Los Angeles, and
We do, yeah.
Do you get much time to come up here to Canada, to Saskatchewan, where you're from?
As much as possible. We were up there last year, and you know, I try to get up like twice a year.
Uh-huh.
But some years it's easier than others, depending on what we're working on. And my parents come down here to see us. So we, you know, I have like the closest relationship with my family. It's just that we have a lot of distance, and it's been that way since I was a kid. But yeah, I stay really connected with friends and family in Saskatoon, and I still very much, and my wife is Irish, she's from Dublin,
uh-huh.
and so she feels very much the same way, that we live here, but it's still very foreign to us, and uh-huh. I feel like I'm still home in Saskatoon in my heart, and she feels like she's still in Dublin, so it's a good way to go about things here, because you look at this city, Los Angeles, as sort of more of a game than a reality, and because people who get too sunken into it, it can be dangerous, you know.
One last thing, Kyle. There are 12 songs on this album. Did you have a say in how they're organized? I know you mentioned, you know, we live in a streaming age, so a lot of people may not be listening to the album when they download it the way in the order that it's set, but did you set that?
Yes. I painstakingly went through it and set the order. I'm still an old school album listener, and I love order, you know, and it flows that way for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I recognize that, like a lot of people, if not most people, don't listen to it that way. But yeah, I like the art of the set list still, or the art of the album track listing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great, I mean, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning makes sense as the first song.
Right.
And then Blue Moon at the end. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, because that's a song that everybody knows, right?
Yeah, it's my dad's favorite.
Yeah. It's been such a delight to talk to you, and this album, as I said.
Oh, thank you so much.
As I said, it's such a good album, and I congratulations on it, and I hope a lot of people pick it up. Best of the season to you.
Thank you so much, man. Happy holidays, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
KyleReabco.com is the website for more. The album is Richard Rodgers Reimagined, and it's from Ghostlight Records. Kyle Reabco joined me on the line from Los Angeles and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.